Welcome to Personal Landscapes. I'm your host, Ryan Murdoch. You can find links for today's episode and other conversations on Books About Place at ryanmurdoch.com. Today I'm speaking with Sarah Anderson, who founded the legendary travel bookshop. She's the author of Halfway to Venus, Sarah Anderson's Travel Companion, and The Lost Art of Silence, and she's also an accomplished painter. You might be familiar with the travel bookshop, even if you've never been to London. It was the inspiration for the shop in a 1998 film called Notting Hill. But that's not our concern here. We're talking books with the woman who curated the reading list for so many journeys, both on and off the map. What are the biggest challenges of running a bookshop? Was there a golden age of literary travel writing? Who are Sarah's favorite forgotten writers about plays? We've got all that and more in the last Personal Landscapes episode of 2023. I'll be back with new conversations for you around mid-January. If you'd like to follow my travels, look me up on Instagram. I usually post a few photos when I get a Wi-Fi connection. Until then, there are lots of older Personal Landscapes conversations to help get you through the holidays. I hope you enjoy this one with Sarah Anderson. Many dedicated readers would think of owning a bookshop as a sort of dream job. So what made you want to take that leap?
Well, I think that if you do have a dream, it's worth pursuing, and some people's dreams can come true. My very first job after leaving school was in a bookshop, and I absolutely loved it. This must have been mid-60s, I suppose, something like that. And I was paid £7 a week, which even in those days was very, very little money. But I would have done it for free. I loved it so much. It was after leaving the bookshop that I decided to go traveling. And when I was traveling, before I traveled, rather, I felt that I wanted to read books about the places that I was going to, not just guidebooks, but fiction and other books set in countries. And so with this dream, I went around the world.
So you said that you did your first trip on a Greyhound bus around the US.
Yes. Yes, that's right. Absolutely. That was 1969. I arrived in New York with a friend of mine in a heavy snowstorm, and I couldn't believe it. New York, just completely shut down. You had to walk everywhere, which was actually great fun. And then we set off and we went round 3 months in a Greyhound bus, which people who live in America hardly ever use Greyhound buses. But they thought that two English girls was quite exceptional and quite eccentric.
Yeah, that was my first big trip as well. I wanted to see a friend in Arizona. So at the time you could get a coast-to-coast ticket for $60, I think. But yeah, you had to start in the U.S. So I had to drive over the border, you know, and got my dad to drive me over the border and dump me off at this grubby Greyhound station with two criminals. I was standing outside, and one guy said, standing outside with these rough characters drinking a coffee, waiting for the bus. And one guy said, I just got out of a halfway house. And the other guy said, I just got out of rehab. And I looked up and said, I just got out of school. And we all kind of nodded and became friends. But yeah, it's like a slice of Jack Kerouac's America, right?
Ours was $99 for 99 days.
Wow.
Which was fantastic.
Such a strange and interesting trip. So you came back from that trip, and that's when you decided to open the bookshop?
No. A lot happens between now and then and the bookshop. I came back from that trip and I fell in love. So I wanted to stay in New York. And of course, I found that very difficult because I didn't have the proverbial green card. And so I literally walked the streets of New York, banging on doors, saying, please give me a job. And I got quite a lot of jobs, which were paid in cash, which was fantastic. And I have American cousins. And so I was living with my cousin. So I was living rent-free. So that was great. And I stayed there for over a year. And then I went back to England for Christmas. And that was my mistake, in a way, because I wasn't allowed back into the States. They said, you must have overstayed you must have worked. Anyway, what they did in those days, which they would never do now, they gave me a 3-month visa on the condition that I promised to leave after 3 months, which I did. And I did. And I didn't want to come back to the UK. And so that's when I set off on my world trip and traveled for about, 9, 10 months, I suppose it was. Most of the time I was with a friend, but she left in Thailand and I went on my own. Then what happened was that when I did get back to England, I didn't know what I wanted to do. So somebody said to me, why don't you come skiing? So I thought, well, that'll fill another 2 weeks. And so I went skiing and I broke my leg incredibly badly. And so I was out of action for about a year, literally. And during that time, well, I had a lot of time to think. And so I thought, well, I've never been to university. I'd like to go to university. And so I applied to do Chinese at SOAS, do you know, School of Oriental and African Studies.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I did that for 4 years. And then I did various bits and pieces, working in other bookshops as well. And I thought, okay, I was by now in my early 30s. If I want to fulfill this dream of having a bookshop, I should do it. And somebody said to me, well, don't just start a general bookshop because it'll just die. Think of a specialization. And so I thought of travel, which made a huge amount of sense. As I said, you know, I'd already discovered that reading books and fiction set in countries is infinitely preferable. And I one of the things I remember well was that I went back at some point when I was planning the shop. I went back to America, which by then I had lots of friends there, obviously. And I talked to them about this idea. And they said to me, that's a wonderful idea, Sarah. But they said, when you get back to England, people will say, don't do it. And that's precisely what happened. But I was so high on the New York buzz, I just went ahead and did it. And it was almost an instant success.
So how unusual was that at the time, a travel specialized bookshop?
Oh, there wasn't anyone. Now, I believe there was actually, to be honest, I believe there was a small shop on the Ile de la Cité or somewhere in Paris, which really had pamphlets more than books about every country. But I was, and there was Stanford's in London, but that was basically maps. So, but I really was the first person to divide the shop into countries and to have everything about that country on one shelf.
Yeah. So you said you knew exactly how you would organize it right from the start, like every biography, history, fiction, guidebooks, maps, new and out of prints, all mixed together on the same shelf. Why did you take that approach?
Well, as I said, when you go to a country, I think you learn much more about it. For example, if you read a novel set in that country, for example, when I was in Japan, I read some books. Now you're going to ask me what they were, and of course I won't remember, but by Japanese authors. I also read Pico Iyer, if that's how you pronounce his name.
He lives in Nara, I think, near Kyoto.
Exactly, yeah. And he's been there 32 years or something. And he said the longer he lives there, the less he understands it. So it's kind of, but I think his book's called something like Japanese for Beginners or something like that. Mm. So that was very instructive. And then I read a couple of novels. One was actually, apparently it's a bestseller. It's got a bookshop in the title. Anything with a bookshop in the title appeals to me. So back to when was this, 1979, roughly. I did think that that would be an original idea. And I did also think that to survive as a bookshop, you had to be original.
So why did you think it was important to include older material?
Because some of the books that were published about countries tell you more about that country than what's current. And I was incredibly lucky in that somebody, I can't remember who actually, introduced me to somebody called Peter Hopkirk.
Yeah.
You know who I mean.
Did you mean the writer Peter Hopkirk?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I think he was still writing for the Times at the time, but he was an avid collector of books on the Middle East and Central Asia. He had the best private collection of books on Central Asia. And he said to me, would I like to go with him every weekend, drive around to secondhand bookshops, and he'd teach me what the kind of book to buy.
Wow.
That was wonderful. So we did that. I used to come back to London with my car laden with books. My flat at the time looked like a warehouse.
So what would you look for then? What kind of eye do you have to apply to find?
Well, I learned so much from Peter. Well, I suppose after a bit, you get to know the names of the people who traveled to various places. And remember that in the late 70s, there weren't any travel reprints. That all started really in the 80s.
Yes, yeah.
So things like Eland and Penguin did a classics series, and there were various others as well. They hadn't begun, they hadn't started. So that if you wanted a book that was out of print, you really had to look for the original copy.
That makes sense. So I can see why a specialty shop like that would be such a gem. Because
yeah.
Eland, I think that was 82. John had started Eland. So
yeah,
it must have been very difficult to find stuff back then. So it's no wonder it became such a success. So it really became quite a London landmark.
Yes, it did. I mean, even before the famous film.
I guess you should mention that for people who, I've never seen it, but.
Oh, have you not? I can't believe you've gone through life and not seen it.
I must have been traveling at the time when that came out, but I'm going to look it up now.
It's on television all the time.
Yeah. So maybe you could tell that story as well for people who don't know or who haven't connected this yet.
Yes. Must have been the late, mid-90s, I suppose. Richard Curtis, who wrote the film, lived around the corner from the bookshop. And he came in one day. He was a customer anyway. And he came in one day and he said he was thinking of writing a film set in a bookshop. Could he sit and take notes? So I said, yes, of course. But I never thought it would happen because people say that kind of thing, then nothing happens. Anyway, he sat several days and took notes. And the next thing I knew was that they were filming Portobello Road. But what I hadn't been told, because I'd been out of the shop, was that people had come and taken some still photographs. And in fact, they took their still photographs and made a set to look like the shop. So they never, ever asked us permission. They just did it. And they didn't actually even give us a credit. But I wrote to Richard Curtis afterwards and I said, I think at least you could have given us a credit. And he said, but you're famous now. And I said, yes, well, it's true. And I have to say, in Japan and Korea, it is quite extraordinary. I'm going to jump ahead now because with my latest book, The Last Art of Silence, they gave me a book launch a couple of nights ago in the bookshop, which was wonderful, actually. Because for me, I said in my little talk at the time, I probably spent more time in that room than any other room in my life. And to have my book launch there was great. And they were telling me that literally thousands of Koreans and Japanese come to have their photographs taken in front of the bookshop.
Wow.
I was quite a sort of figure in Japan. I mean, I was quite a celebrity in Japan. People knew, they go, oh! So, but it is true that it is very, very well known. But what's extraordinary, what they were saying was that they've just done a deal, the people who now own the bookshop, with, I think it's a Korean airline, whereby when anyone brings a boarding pass from this airline into the bookshop, they get a discount.
So did they film any scenes there at all, or did they just model the place?
No, they didn't actually, no. They just built the set to look like it. The only things they filmed actually in Portobello Road. Well, you haven't seen the film, but there's one wonderful sequence when they wander down the road and the seasons change. Uh-huh. And that was actually done, I think, in Portobello Road.
Mm-hmm. So did they show up at the shop to browse around to get us to the feel of the place?
We had Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant in the shop at some point. Yes.
Buy any books?
I don't know. I think one of them did. I wasn't there, sadly, but I think I did ask that question. And I think I was told one of them did and one of them didn't. And I can't remember which round it was. So
in your years of running this place, what's the biggest challenge of running a bookshop?
Well, first of all, everyone thinks totally erroneously that, oh, how wonderful, you can sit and read all day. I honestly think that in over 30 years of having the bookshop, I didn't read more than a paragraph. There's constantly, because especially if it's since it was my own business. I mean, I did absolutely everything. Initially, I just had a part-time helper. I think she came in 2 days a week, and I was there. Well, I closed on a Monday, but I was there, you know, on my own for most of the time. And so, I mean, so apart from the sort of base, you have to do the cleaning, you have to do the ordering of the books, you have to do the cataloging of them when they come in. You have to deal with customers. You have to look and see what books are being published. And it's just full time, full on, actually. Very enjoyable. And I met such interesting people. Of course, the frustration was that I couldn't leave the shop. So all these people I met were going on these wonderful trips.
Oh, yeah, that's terrible.
Stuck in the shop. but eventually I did get a very good Australian manager. And so I felt that I could go away. Mm-hmm. So that was, and start traveling again. And that's when I started writing. There was a magazine called Departures,
which was
American Express magazine. And I knew the editor, and they rang me at one point and they said, "We've got this fascinating trip to Sri Lanka. Some eccentric Englishman had found a steam engine in the jungle in Sri Lanka and spent years doing it up. And his inaugural trip is coming up. Do you know anyone who could go to write about it?" And I said, "I'd think about it." And I rang them back and I said, "Well, there's always me." And so they sent me. So that was my first writing commission.
So had you written anything before that or published anything?
No, don't think so.
Wow.
This in the 80s. And after that, it meant that, as you probably know, I think things are completely different now. I wouldn't attempt to do any travel journalism, but you needed to know the editor.
Yes, yeah.
That hasn't changed. Okay. So I got to know the travel editors of the FT, the Mail on Sunday, the Guardian. And so whenever I went away, I could just get in touch with them and say, "Would you like a piece?" Uh-huh. And the pay and the money was quite good. I mean, now I believe you get nothing.
Yeah, that's changed. That changed a lot.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, then the type of trips also changed. I guess when I started out, I was able to get assignments to interesting places and they would set up the trips for me. I could say, you know, we want to do a story of Jordan. Can you get me two camels and a Bedouin? And they would track this down and turn me loose, you know, but that stopped, God, 10 years ago at least. And I find there didn't seem to be so many people publishing long narrative pieces anymore. Like back in the heyday of this stuff, you had Holiday Magazine. At its peak, they were publishing like Jack Kerouac, Truman Capote, Hemingway, Faulkner, Paul Bowles, these kind of writers. And then you had the Sunday Times publishing great travel writing. And I remember Lawrence Millman telling me about Islands magazine back in his early days. They would send him to places like Yap and Pompeii and Micronesia. It's so hard to get to. But then the editor changed and the magazine did too. And that was it. So, I mean, do you know of any publications now? Who's publishing great travel writing now?
No. That's the answer. Short answer, no.
I mean, COVID killed off the last ones that I knew about.
Yeah. Because everything's online, I suppose, isn't it? I mean, or anyone can publish anything they want online. That's the downside.
So we no longer have your bookshop to guide us, but you did publish a massive reading list that's sure to lead somebody like me to financial ruin. So what is Anderson's Travel Companion and how did you put that together?
Well, I went through it yesterday thinking about what you'd said about travel writers who are neglected. To be honest, I'm totally amazed at how I could do it because this was before Word. I mean, I was thinking, did I do it on an Amstrad or did I literally do it on card indexes? I mean, you've got one tiny bit of it, but it is really substantial. I was approached by Scola Press to do it. And I was so flattered. This must have been about 1995 it was published. And it probably took me 3 years or something. But I So they suggested that I do effectively a book of the shop. And so it is arranged like the shop was arranged. So under continent, and then subdivided the continent, subdivided into countries, and then into categories. And because I lived above the shop, I would go down for a couple of hours every day before the shop opened, and sort of go through the shelves. But I also spent quite a lot of time in the British Library when it was still in the British Museum. And it's people still think of it as the Bible, but it's so out of date. And the sad thing is that it would be such a wonderful resource online.
Yeah.
I'm not prepared to do it. And at one point, the Times, the London Times, said that they would like me to license it to them. And so we got really quite far along that path. And the techie people from the Times came to my flat and we went through the whole thing. And then it didn't happen. But that would be, because to update it would be easy.
Yes, yeah.
But to just do the whole thing from scratch, no, I'm not prepared to do that.
That's a lot of work. And it's such a great resource. I mean, I was going through this smaller version that I have here, and there's so much of it still holds up really well. Some of these books would be quite hard to find now, I think, but
yes,
there's an awful lot of it that wouldn't be. And as you said before, these older books tell you so much about a place.
Yeah.
Like you can read these older accounts and then travel to a place now and see what the continuities are, what are the fundamentals of the culture that remain the same, and what superficial aspects change. But those deep threads, captured in a really good writing, they don't seem to change very much. So this slimmer volume I have here, the Africa and the Middle East, did you end up doing?
I published that myself, actually, didn't I?
Yeah, I think so. And did you end up doing the other ones, breaking down the rest of it? Because I tried tracking those down, I couldn't find them.
No, I didn't. No. But I don't know whether you can still get the original. I mean, I've got a few copies. If you really want one, I could send you one.
Oh, sure. I'll buy one off you.
I think I've got a few copies.
If you find any, I'd love to. Yeah. This will ruin me. I mean, I'm already teetering on the brink financially, but this will completely finish me off. But I'm fine with that. God, so many good books in here.
Yeah.
So how important then is pre-trip reading for you?
Well, to be honest, I normally am so busy just before going on a trip that I don't do much pre-trip reading. But it's when I'm on the trip, I do the reading. But I really like, I like talking to people about books, and I like their recommendations very much. Whereas I think most of my reading is done actually through recommendations of other people. Some are disasters, but some are real gems that you discover. And I just, the books on Japan I read, they're in the bestseller list actually at the moment, paperback bestseller list.
Oh, wow. So you must have come across Murakami, Haruki Murakami. He's massive now. He captures Tokyo really well.
Apparently, I went to a talk recently on translation. Which was very interesting. And the woman was saying that it's nonsense that the demographic, sort of 20 to 35-year-olds, don't read. She said they do. They're reading in translation.
Yeah.
And they're reading Japanese and Korean fiction mostly.
Yeah. Yeah, Japanese is great. It's quite a boom. Yeah. I think partly because of him. But there are a lot of other writers I see in the bookshops around here, Japanese writers. Yeah. And Murakami also translates. I think he translated Raymond Chandler into Japanese and Paul Theroux.
Right.
He's also written some books of travel in Japanese, but they've never been translated as far as I know.
I remember reading when I was originally in Tokyo, I mean, back in 1970, Silence.
Yeah, Endo Shusaku. Endo. Yeah.
So they then made into a film. I don't know whether you saw that.
I've never seen the film.
Yeah. I can't remember who it was now, who was in it. Anyway, it was good.
I read a lot of Japanese literature.
Do you speak Japanese?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I can get by. I can't read as well anymore, just barely. But speaking just casually isn't too difficult. But when I lived in the western suburbs of Tokyo, beside a cabbage patch, I happened to the main urban center in that area had a very good library. I think the Americans had a base there at one point or something. So they had an English section that was completely full of translations of Japanese classics. So I spent those 2 years, you know, really plunging into that. Some really interesting stuff. So I wanted to ask you also about some travel writing as a genre. I mean, I think it's a loose one, and place writing can be bring in so many things. But so 19th century travel books seem to be mostly dry accounts of exploration. And it's only in the 20th century that we begin to see what we would think of as travel literature. Why do you think that was, for one thing?
Well, one of the things that I've learned over the years is that you do not call people like Bruce Chatwin or Jonathan Raban travel writers. Mm. They hate that. Yeah. Well, they're both dead now, but they hated that label. They are writers who travel. So they are writing literature. And I think one of the extraordinary things about the 19th century, especially those amazing women travelers in the 19th century, is that a lot of them were semi-invalids.
Yes.
Because I think they came mostly from this country. And it's when they, the moment they sort of hit abroad, they flourished. It's quite extraordinary. So I think a lot of their writing is more, it's as you say, it's not probably great literature, but it is extraordinary what they're doing.
Hmm. So give us a few examples for people who want to look some up.
Well, there's Gertrude Bell, there's Mary Kingsley, mm-hmm. I'm sure I'll think of some more.
Edith Durham, she came a bit later than that, but she Edith was Durham very much was one later. Of those characters. I did a podcast on her for anybody who's listening and wants to learn about her.
And then, of course, Freya Stark was much later. You've done one with Caroline Moorhead, I think.
We did, yeah. We talked about some Martha Gellhorn, but I'd love to do one on Freya Martha Stark Gellhorn. As well.
Okay. She would be the person for that as well, actually, yes.
Oh, she was great, yeah.
Yeah, she's a good friend. There was, of course, the woman who painted... and she's got a whole room at Kew, Marianne North.
Oh, I don't know her.
Yeah. A whole room at Kew, which is different. I mean, her paintings aren't wonderful. I mean, they're not very, but in that the whole room, it's rather like a Victorian, all the walls are covered with her painting. And it's the general effect, which is just amazing.
Where did she travel? Where was she painting?
Mostly in South America.
Hmm.
Southern America, or various different countries.
To come back to what you said about travel writing being such a terrible label these days, I think it's because of the magazines and this sort of the idea, this sort of, you know, become a travel writer, travel for free, you know, yes, the global exactly. sponge sort of image. That's why I've called the podcast Conversations on Books About Place, because that's I grew to hate that label as well. It was cool when you're in your 20s and traveling for free, but it was a lot harder work than that makes it out to sound.
But I think I was very lucky because the late 70s, early 80s were really the golden age of new travel writing.
I mean, this is what I wanted to ask you about. Was there a golden age?
I think so. I mean, there was Bruce Chatwin, Paul Theroux, Jonathan Raban, Colin Subran, Gavin Young, and I'm sure Norman Lewis, well, he was slightly earlier, but was rediscovered then. That's enough those are all extremely good writers of literature who happen to travel. And I don't think, as far as the 50s and 60s didn't really produce, I think actually Norman Lewis was writing in the 50s and 60s, but I don't think he had much of a market. Until John Hatt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, exactly, yeah.
Rediscovered him. So all those people were traveling. And then there were, as I say, these travel reprints that started. The wonderful John Hatt with Eland, which still goes strong, Eland, which is great. Yeah.
Barnaby was my first guest.
Oh, was he? Yeah. Was he? and also, it seems extraordinary, and guidebooks. Because mm-hmm. Rough Guides and Lonely Planet,
from the same period.
About that time, exactly. Because when I remember when I started the shop, there wasn't a single book to what was then Czechoslovakia. And by the time I, well, in the 2000s, I think there was something like 30 guides just to Prague. I mean, there had been an explosion. Everyone, anyway. But this is the thing about publishers. I mean, they're not very innovative. Most of them, I think, what they do. I mean, they what they want to publish is what was a success in the last season.
Hmm.
And so they jump on the bandwagon, and often it's too late.
Yes,
one of the things I said in my little talk on Tuesday at the book launch, because my book was just published in America. It wasn't published here. It's distributed here by Penguin, but it's published by Shambhala in America. And they have been so proactive. And all the other writers in the room at the book launch were saying, because their publishers here aren't.
Oh, that's interesting.
They're really not.
So they're just not as marketing savvy as the Americans?
Seemingly not.
I wonder why that is.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think if you're well known, then it's fine. Then you get lot of publicity.
You sell yourself at that point. But if you're well known, you don't need it.
Exactly. So people like Jeffrey Archer. I mean, they really need a publicist.
So this 80s renaissance too, I have a quote here from the, there was this celebrated travel writing issue of Granta magazine in 1984. And the editor, Bill Buford, said, travel writing is undergoing a revival, evident not only in the busy reprinting of travel classics, but in the staggering number of new travel writers emerging. Not since the 1930s has travel writing been so popular or so important. So what was it about the 80s?
And do you have that book in front of you? I've got it somewhere.
No, I don't think I have that. I've got a later edition of that Granta travel.
I wonder who was in it out of interest.
I should look that up. Yeah, I don't know. They did another one.
Yes, they did.
Must have been the early 2000s. I think I bought it in Japan.
Right.
But yeah, what was it about the 80s that made this such a, was it just the ease of travel at that time, or this conjunction of great writers is interesting?
Well, yes, I don't know. I mean, was it, that's what I don't remember. Was it easy to travel? Actually, I remember in England anyway, I think there was a recession in the early 80s, which again, people said, you know, you're crazy to start a business in a recession. But then somebody else advised me. They said, actually, it's the best possible time, because if it's going to work, then it'll stagger through the recession and then explode when the recession ends. So I don't think it was that easy. And I'm not sure, certainly until I remember having to write in the back of our passports every time you took money abroad, and you were allowed to take something like £15. I mean, but on the other hand, traveling was cheap. And when I did my round the world trip, admittedly, I did have a round the world air ticket, but I think I spent something like £350, you know, in something like 8 or 9 months. I mean, it was just extraordinary. People were very kind, you know, we often went to stay with people I heard, I don't know whether this is an apocryphal story or not, but of course, once there is email, then if you're a parent, you worry if you don't hear. I heard this story that there was a child, 18, 19-year-old, who was in Bangalore, and they missed a train. So they rang up mummy and said, "Miss my train, what shall I do?"
Yeah, that's a different world. I harp on about this all the time. Yeah. The pre-internet age of travel was very different.
I didn't get in touch. I got in touch with my parents. I wrote those blue airmail letters.
Yes.
And collected them from American Express.
Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to make a phone call, you had to go to some kind of government phone.
I didn't. Not Central in America. 10 months. I mean, it would have
been. Fill out a form and they tell you go to the booth. And yes, I mean, you might do this once a month.
So it's
completely. So I wonder how much that had to do with it, the recession back home, because there was that other kind of great peak of travel writing between the wars, where you saw Robert Byron, Norman Douglas, Lawrence, Evelyn Waugh, and Lawrence Thurl mentioned being driven away by currency controls. He could live more cheaply in Corfu.
I mean, it's funny how it seems to go in blocks. I hadn't really thought about it before. You're quite right. I mean, that pre-war, between the wars.
Yeah.
Those writers. And then, as I say, I think the 50s were pretty Well, they were pretty gloomy anyway, post-war. It was pretty Spartan. And then I don't know whether, I don't know what, I have no idea what it was, why there was this explosion.
Yeah, it's interesting. It just comes in waves, because there was another a 90s generation after those great writers of the 80s. That's when I think we started to see Sarah Wheeler and William Dalrymple, you know, Rory MacLean, Eric Hansen.
Yeah, Philip Marston. Yeah. Yes, it's true. But I don't know, well, perhaps I should, I don't know that they'll last in the same way as some of those. I don't know. And I mean, I'm totally out of the loop now. Yeah. I don't know if there are some young other.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you about. What's the state of the genre today? Like, there are some interesting writers who came out in the 2000s, like the Kapka Kasabova, who writes about the Balkans.
Yes.
Richard Grant is a fantastic writer. I barely look at new travel books unless it's recommended to me or by a writer I know. Like, I find there's just too much obsession with the current identity politics and attempting to right historical wrongs, and usually at the expense of the writing. Like, it's the publishers get caught up in these trends that are sort of the flavor of the month, and they don't last. And I want to read something that's lasting. There's so many great older books I haven't read.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So you were a judge for the Thomas Cook Travel Book Award. That's, the list of winners is outstanding. I mean, some of the finest writing of the time.
Yeah.
How did that work for those who aren't familiar with book award panels? Like, how were they selected? Who were the other judges?
We had, I think there were two categories. There was a guidebook category and travel literature. And it was, well, obviously run by Thomas Cook, the travel agents, I suppose you call them, I don't know. And I had met somebody called Edmund Swinglehurst, who organized the prize. And he asked me to be on, I think I was on the very first panel. And then I did it sort of every year. And it was a question of being sent the travel books that they, I suppose, they thought might win. I think that's how it happened. I've just actually been reading for another prize, and I've decided I'll never ever do it again.
Why not? Too many books to read?
55 books.
God.
It meant that for the last 3 months, I honestly haven't read anything that I wanted to read. I've just been reading this prize, which is the first biography prize. Anyway, but for the Thomas Cook one, as far as I remember, we didn't have to read that many books. And I remember meeting, we used to have lunches, and there were about six of us on the panel. I can't remember who they were. I do remember that every year, the chairman of Thomas Cook, whoever it was sat on the panel as well. And I also remember that if he particularly liked a book, that book would win.
He must have had good taste, because the winners are incredibly good.
And I think sometimes we gave it sort of for a lifetime's award rather than for a particular book.
I think there were only two that won twice. Jonathan Rabin won twice. I can't remember if Old Glory and Coasting, maybe those two, or what? I don't remember. Hunting Mr. Heartbreak might have been.
I think Bruce Chatwin said he didn't want to be entered.
Yes, he withdrew because he said his writing was fiction. Exactly. And then Stanley Stewart won twice too, I believe.
Oh, yes.
And those are the only two that I can think of. Yeah, that's been a great source for me to look for books to talk about on this podcast. You know, do you know if it's possible to find the shortlist for that award anywhere? I found one online for the very last one, and the shortlisted books were also really great.
Yeah, I don't know. I can look back at my old, but I think it's probably pre. I mean, it was before I had a. Computer, I think. Otherwise, it would all be stored somewhere. But I'll have a. I mean, if I discover anything, I'll certainly let you know.
Oh, please, I emailed Thomas Cook recently, but nobody answered me. Like their media department.
I'm not even sure they still exist. Really, I think they've gone. I'm not sure they have.
Anybody associated with the books would be long gone, I'm sure. But
yes.
I think the last, the final award was Richard Grant's Ghost Riders. Travels with American Nomads. I did a podcast on that as well. Fantastic book. But I found that shortlist, and Louisa Waugh's book on Mongolia was on that. And I just spoke to her recently. That was a fantastic, I wouldn't have found it if I hadn't seen that shortlist.
But I mean, actually Barnaby is the person who might know, because I mean, he because I can't remember, there was a man's name who took over the prize. So it's called the Thomas Cook. Can you remember?
The Stanford's does something similar now, but it's not as good. I mean, I found that goes in peaks and troughs.
Yeah. But anyway, Barnaby was quite involved at one point.
I'll check with him.
Yeah.
So do you have any favorite books from those years as a judge?
If I had to choose some of these writers, I mean, I think Bruce Chatwin is right up there. And I think Jonathan Raven is as well.
Yeah, Jonathan Raven's fantastic. Yeah.
I mean, I actually think that the Bruce Chatwin's best book is On the Black Hill.
That's one I really liked as well.
Yeah, it's not really a travel book in a sense, but but I think, I mean, in Patagonia was, I suppose, one of the first that set off this boom, didn't it? I'm not sure.
Yeah, that would make sense.
What year it was actually published, but I could look it up actually. 77. 1977.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. When did Paul Theroux publish The Great Railway Bazaar?
That was early as well. 75 was The Great Railway Bazaar.
Oh, wow. So very early. So this.
Yeah. Yeah.
The stirrings of that early 80s boom
exactly.
then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were extant in the 70s. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So I saw somewhere that you said good travel writing is probably one of the hardest things to do and not one of the easiest, as many people thought. So why did you think that?
Because I think that, if we talk about travel journalism, that's what a lot of people think of as travel writing, I think. And that is, needs sort of information and, you know, X, Y, and Z. And it's very, I suppose anyone really could do that. It's not difficult. But to make a place come alive and to sort of be able to describe a spirit of place, I think it's one of the hardest things you can do well. And therefore, I don't think you don't have to go to deepest, darkest Africa or an unknown place. You can write about somewhere which is actually well known and still create this magic if you're a good writer.
So what does it take? What makes great writing about plays? What are the characteristics?
Oh, gosh. As I say, you recreate the spirit of that place. How you do that with writing, I don't know, but I think the good writers do that. And I'm not sure that that's something you can necessarily be taught to do.
Yeah.
I think that's something which is innate.
Yeah, you have to have the ability to tap into that in the first place and connect with it.
Yeah. I think one of the things nowadays, of course, which people complain about, but I'm going to contradict myself now, is that they say, well, everywhere's been gone to, there's nowhere new to discover. So travel writing can't exist. But as I said earlier on, I don't think it matters. If you're a good writer, you can write about, you know, your local park in a way, and you could travel through that and make it alluring.
Well, Jonathan Raven's a great example of that. I mean, in Hunting Mr. Heartbreak, he takes the emigrant experience, that gets on a ship and travels to America the way that our forefathers did, the way my grandparents traveled to Canada in the 30s and explores these communities that are kind of forgotten about or just overlooked if you live there. Or the Badlands, his account of Eastern Montana and the people that hardscrabble farmers who settled these places, you know, he just pulled those stories out of these arid plains in such a compelling way. But I think if you lived in those places, you'd find nothing of interest there. You just wouldn't see it.
No, that's right. I remember I saw him in Seattle, actually. I can't remember the year, but I was driving from Seattle to Montana through the Rockies. And before mobile phones, again, everyone said I was mad, but I did it. Anyway, I remember having dinner with Jonathan in Seattle and him. It must have been just about the time when his Badlands, it had just come out, I think. So he knew Montana well.
That's a great book. I just read that recently again.
Yes, I went to, there was a sort of memorial service for him recently at Daunt's Bookshop in Narrabeen.
Another great bookshop.
I mean, yes, it is. But they started 10 years after me.
When I read about how you categorize your bookshop, I thought they must have copied that.
Yeah. Right. Anyway, I mean, Daunt's was a purpose-built bookshop. I don't know whether you knew that.
No.
Yeah. It was before Daunce, it was something called Francis Edwards, and it's sort of late 19th century as a built as a bookshop. Have you been there ever or not?
Yes, yeah. Just once. I attended a talk by John Julius Norwich there.
Okay, right.
A beautiful room. That,
yes, it's lovely. I mean, it really is fantastic.
Two-story cavernous open expanse. Great.
One of the other things that happened to me was that I think the first bookshop in Britain to computerize our books, to have them all on, because what happened was there was a woman called Anne Williams who was American, and she came to England to try and sell a bookselling program called Wordstock, which was made by booksellers for booksellers. And it was really brilliant, actually. It just did everything you wanted it to do. The problem was, so what happened was that Anne was a friend of a friend. So I gave her a desk in the back of the shop, and in return, she gave us the program. So I literally the first. But what they use some weird system called QNX or something, which means that you can only use it on an old computer. So it's because Daunce had it. I don't know what Daunce do now.
So that must have opened up a lot more possibilities as a bookshop too, because especially a specialty bookshop, I mean, you can, when everything's computerized, people can call you up from anywhere.
Yes, and
and track down books, or now you can order anything online.
Yeah. But that was obviously before then. I mean, I'm just so glad that Amazon didn't really exist when I had. I mean, I don't know how you compete really, because people.
Well, there's a lot of secondhand shops that seem to still do okay, like Abe Books and there's one here
online,
in Germany.
Yes.
Yes, no, because you can order from.
I believe Abe is owned by Amazon, actually.
Is it now?
I think so.
there's a local German one. I don't know who owns that. But they'll source books from bookstores all over the place here.
But as I was saying,
you can often find good ones.
You know, like what I used to do with Peter Hopke, going around all these secondhand bookshops. They don't exist anymore. Very few exist now.
That's really terrible.
It's sad. Although new books, apparently last year, certainly in the UK, more new independent bookshops opened than closed. So that's reassuring.
Good. Yeah. But that's the magic of a secondhand bookshop is you can't replace that online. Like that's the thing that Amazon will never replicate. Yeah. Their recommendation process, you know, if you bought this, you might like this. Yes. At first it seemed appealing, but you don't have that serendipity when you walk into a secondhand bookshop and something falls off the shelf and you realize. Yeah. There are two very good ones in Berlin, two English language ones. But Peter Hopkirk, what was he like? I've got The Great Game on my pile to reread next week for a trip. And
where are you going?
I'm going to Uzbekistan.
Oh, really? I was there earlier this year, actually.
Okay, we're going for Christmas over that that period. So, I mean, just to see the places that he wrote about, that's what drew me there. I came across Foreign Devils on the Silk Road 20 years ago. I bumped into a Canadian in Kashgar in a bar, and he was carrying this, and we ended up traveling the Taklamakan, the south parts, you know, to look for camels so we could go into the desert. And he had this book of Peter Hopkirk, and I went on to read everything he wrote.
Oh, Peter would have been thrilled. So as I say, he was extremely generous with his knowledge and did have this. And of course, he and the other people who do this, who literally, I don't know what they call themselves, but book hunters, because Peter knew exactly the books that he didn't have. So when he saw a book in a secondhand bookshop, it was so exciting. And that doesn't happen if you look online. I mean, it's either there or it's not there. As you say, the serendipity has completely gone. So as I say, he was extremely generous with his knowledge. And I learned, that's why at the time, I can't say I've still remembered it all, but I knew much more about books on Central Asia and the Middle East than anywhere else. I mean, South America, I never ever knew much about South America. Although I don't think there's as much great literature about South America as there is about Central Asia.
No, Central Asia is a treasure trove. Central Asia and Africa, there seems to be so much.
Yeah.
And the Middle East as well.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about is underappreciated writers about place. Since you're an encyclopedia of this
Okay.
This type of genre. So I did people who have forgotten about her aren't widely read today. Like,
yeah.
Who would your picks be?
Well, I don't know what's happened to him. Somebody called James Hamilton Patterson, who wrote a book called Playing with Water about the Philippines. I absolutely loved that.
So tell us about that book. What is it about?
Shall I just read what I wrote?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. An extraordinarily moving and evocative book, which combines the story of the author's life fishing for survival on the remote Philippine island of Tiwarik with a journey of inner exploration. Unforgettable, the Philippine landscape and these remote islanders are crystalline and at the same time mysterious, the writing itself superb, so wrote Ronald Blythe. And Andrew Harvey wrote a classic travel book, entirely original, at once astringently and gorgeously written. Everyone in despair at contemporary literature should read it.
Wow.
Highly recommended. So, yeah.
Oh, I'll track this down. One.
I don't know of anything else that he wrote. I don't know anything else about him, actually.
Yeah, that's a place that's not, I don't see too many books about the Philippines. No. I can't think of a single one offhand. Paul Theroux's written about it in short pieces, but quite long ago.
So who else? Well, I mean, slightly different different time. Ibn Battuta.
Yes.
I thought it was fantastic. I loved. I remember Beryl Markham's West with the Night.
Oh, it's a fantastic book. Yeah.
Thesiger. Again, I'm not sure that his writing is so wonderful, but it's what he does. So there is that. It's more exploration, isn't it, than beautiful travel. Yeah. But still.
Tough journeys.
Yeah. Mark Twain. He wrote a lot of travel stuff, actually. I don't know if people still read Mark Twain, do they?
I don't know. I've got Innocents Abroad here on my shelf, but I don't know if people still read that. Roughly. Humor is difficult, too. He wrote a lot of humorous stuff, and it's hard to get across sometimes. I think that comes in peaks and troughs.
Geoffrey Moorhouse?
Yes. Fantastic. Yeah. He wrote, The Fearful Void?
Yes.
Calcutta. A fantastic desert book.
Yeah, and a book of Calcutta. He wrote. Oh, yes, and another, Vikram Seth.
Oh, yes. He wrote one on Central Asia.
He wrote, yes, he did.
Ah, what is the name of this? Something, I think a lake in the name.
Yes, you're quite right. Let me think. From Heaven Lake.
That's it, yes.
Yeah. But he also wrote, I don't know whether you ever read it, which is, it's called Golden Gate.
No.
Which is in verse. I think he's an extraordinary writer, actually. I think it's set in California, I think. But it's not really a travel book, but it's. I thought it was a wonderful book. Peter Matheson's Snow Leopard.
Oh, yes. Fantastic book. He did one on the Mosquito Keys as well. It's all dialect. Fantastic book.
I haven't read that.
What is that called?
Far Tortuga.
Yes, Far Tortuga. Yeah, it's about the Mosquito Keys off the Mosquito Coast.
I can't remember.
Yeah, brilliant.
It's obviously ingrained. Nicolas Bouvier.
Yes, The Way of the World is one of my favorites.
Exactly. And Eric Newby, I think, has kind of gone out of fashion.
Yeah. But I think people still read him. I mean, Short Walk in the Hindu Kush was...
Yes,
it's quite a landmark book.
Eothen.
Ah, yeah. I wonder if people read that anymore.
I don't know. Did one of these travel reprints do it? They must have done, actually.
Definitely, yeah.
Okay, so those are the ones that I wrote down.
You've also mentioned Robert Byron's Road to Oxiana as a favorite of yours. Is he still read today, do you think? I mean, I still read him, but I don't know I can never tell if I'm typical or weird.
I think it's still in print, the Road to Oxiana. I mean,
that
what
one
I
for sure
particularly
is.
Liked about it was actually going. I was in Iran and going to the place where he described the squinch in a ruined mosque, and it was just that sort of connection. I think I love the fact that you can connect with a place or with whoever was there through the writing of somebody you're reading. Yeah, good.
Yeah. Another one of my favorites that doesn't seem to be read anymore is Gavin Young.
Oh, yeah.
In Search of Conrad, I really liked.
That. Yeah, yeah.
I found that, and then I tracked down. I was doing a magazine assignment in Wales And we forced the local guy they paired us up with to take us to Heianwai, and I found Slow Boats to China and Slow Boats Home. I've been looking for those for years. Yeah, such an enjoyable writer. In Search of Conrad, that's one of my favorites too. There's a scene where Thesiger ends up coming over there to Indonesia or someplace, and you see him just sweating and uncomfortable sitting in the bottom of the sailboat, completely out of his normal element where you would picture him to be. That's a great scene. But I don't know if anybody reads Gavin Young anymore. I'd like to do a podcast on him as well.
I don't know who would be the person to... I don't think he's in print. I think I've heard criticism that he was sort of more of a journalist than a...
He did do a lot of journalism, I think. But yeah. I mean, yeah. In Search of Conrad. And
do you have do you have a wonder? You keep looking. Do you have a wonderful travel library yourself?
Yeah, I've got a big shelf here on the left. Yeah, I can't quite see that far anymore, though. too much time staring at books. So, did any of these kind of characters come into the shop back in those days?
Oh yeah, I mean, I met all these people.
Wow.
That we've been talking about. Well, obviously not Ibn Battuta, but yes. And we had book launches for them. And yeah, I think, and everyone, I mean, Jan Morris.
Wow.
When she heard about the shop, she wrote me a little note. And actually, this is really nice. You know that Sarah Wheeler is writing her biography.
Yes, I'm waiting for this. Yeah.
And so Sarah was going through all Jan Morris's papers, and she found the note from me back in 1980, which I had written thanking Jan Morris for her enthusiasm about the shop. So
wow,
it's really nice.
So, who were the highlights, and were there any scandalous incidents at any of these launches? Like, did anybody get really, really drunk and cause chaos?
No, I can't. I'd tell you if I... No, I don't think so. I'm sorry. No, I think it was really all quite...
Well-behaved.
Well-behaved and civilized, yeah.
That sort of thing happens more on press trips, I think.
Yes, I do remember, as I was telling you, this press trip, my very first one to Sri Lanka. Because I can't remember who they were, but they were all journalists, and they literally did start drinking at 9 o'clock in the morning because it was all free.
Yes.
And I thought, oh my God,
And I did two press trips, I think, on the back of like more interesting narrative journeys, the kind of thing where they set you up with the sort of trip that I would want to do, and they'd say, oh, why don't you join this press trip for free, You can ride along and see the rest of the country. And it was always like that, on the bus, off the bus, a lot of people drinking all the time. Not very interesting. So before we end off, I wanted to ask you about your new book. It just came out the other day. Tell us what that's about and where can people find it?
Okay.
Shambhala, you said, is the publisher.
Yes, it's published by Shambhala, but distributed certainly in the UK by Penguin Random House. Mm-hmm. It's called The Lost Art of Silence, subtitle Reconnecting to the Power and Beauty of Quiet. Mm. And I couldn't find a publisher in the UK. And I couldn't find an agent. And I was just about to start crowdfunding and doing it myself, because it's a book that I've been working on and off for 10 years, I suppose. And so I sent one email to Shambhala, and they had published in the 90s, I did something called the Virago Book of Women's Spirituality. Mm-hmm. And Shambhala did the American edition called Heaven's Face Thinly Veiled. So I did have a slight connection to Shambhala, although it's now owned by different people. Anyway, so I just sent them one email and they said yes. So they've been an absolute delight to work with, I can tell you.
What's the crux of the book? How are you exploring silence?
Well, I mean, we live, as we all know, in an incredibly noisy world. And I just think that as a result of that, I think creativity needs silence. I also think that if you're constantly listening to stuff or overwhelmed by noise, you don't listen to other people. So you need silence to absorb what other people are saying. And I think that's very important. And so it's a kind of cultural history of silence, I suppose. I've looked at how you can find silence in literature, in art, in music, funnily enough, and in deserts. And I've also, I was encouraged to put quite a bit of myself in it, which I was semi-reluctant to do, but I've done. So sort of my experiences of silence, and I'm not a particular, I mean, I find silence quite difficult. But I mean, I do live alone, but I do often have the radio on. Anyway, it seems to have hit a chord. It seems to just be the right time, yes, frankly. And I think
in a culture of overwhelming noise, yeah.
Getting quite a lot of attention in America, which is great.
The place that needs it most, I think. No offense to my American listeners.
From my own point of view, I mean, it's a much bigger market,
yes,
America.
It's massive,
than it is,
yeah.
Here. So
where do you find silence?
I mean, it sounds very trite to say in nature, but I was in Antarctica in 2005, I think, and we were on a Russian icebreaker, and what happened was that we got off onto Zodiacs and were going in and out of the icebergs. And then the guy turned the engine off, and then it began to snow, and it was completely silent. And it was the most wonderful feeling. And I think that's what I say in the book. It's a kind of device, really, that I've been trying to recapture that silence ever since. I mean, is anything, I mean, even now, sitting here, I mean, I can hear my fridge in the background. I mean, finding actual silence is very difficult. Evidently, the most silent place in the States is in Olympic Park in Washington State. Oh. And they've got a little red block there saying that this is the most silent place, but there's apparently no planes fly over.
Okay, yeah.
But of course, it's noisy. I mean, you can actually look at it on YouTube. And, you know, there are forest sounds. So, you know, then you have to say, is it just human sounds or is it? But I think that certainly here in the first lockdown, when fewer planes, it's definitely quieter.
But it's hard to even to escape the noise of yourself.
Well, quite. Exactly. And there are all these people who try and, you know, go into the desert and your own body sounds are so loud sometimes you can hear your heart thumping and your tummy.
It's really amazing. Yeah. That happened twice. I've had that experience in the central Sahara in the Tibesti Mountains in Chad, and then in the middle of Iceland as well. There's that uninhabited central highlands. I did a story there. We took my wife and I took a 4x4, and I got a bunch of topo maps, and we just followed obscure little tracks out to the furthest bits that we could find up in the highlands. And I remember camping there just in the middle of nothing, and I'm trying to fall asleep. And then I heard this noise. I thought, well, it's an engine. Somebody's driving up here. Like, who the hell would it? Who's out here? And then I realized it's the blood in my ears, like my pulse in my own ears. I thought it was a truck coming up the road. Really amazing. That's how quiet it was. When the wind dies down, that's what you hear.
And there are these places called, are they anechoic chambers?
Mm. The silent rooms with all the weird padding, the soundproof rooms.
Which people can't hack.
Don't you go mad after a certain period of time?
Even, I mean, I think 40 minutes is the limit, and most people give up after a very, very short time. It's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, I find anyway.
Did you ever do a silent retreat? One of these?
Oh, yes. No, I did a lot of these things for the book. Yeah, I did.
So what is it like?
You've never done a silent retreat. Well, it's, I mean, I do, it's sort of ironic, but I find silence quite difficult. You know, there are sort of days almost when I don't talk to people, but I don't think of it as, well, that's probably not true, actually. I always go out at some point during the day, and therefore I've obviously, you know, have interaction with other people. So silent retreats, I did one in Spain, a Buddhist silent retreat specifically for the book. But it wasn't, I found it quite difficult. Because what you normally have are talks, during the day.
Yeah, okay.
You have times for meditation and you're just not talking to people. But I found that, for example, eating, in the evening, I found that really quite difficult because the food was really not very good. And there you were, you're very aware of the food when you're talking, at least when you're talking to people, you can...
You don't notice bad cooking as much.
You don't mind the bad cooking so much, exactly. But I'm not sure that... I don't know that I got a lot out of it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what is the benefit of these types of things versus just cultivating more habits of silence in your own life or going to places that are totally silent to experience being disconnected?
I suppose I think of it as something that I should do, in that I think that it will make me... Well, I think it does make you sort of think, assess your life. I mean, I'm such a butterfly, frankly. I like doing lots and lots of different kinds of things. And I think that if you are thrown into silence, which it terrifies a lot of people, it doesn't frighten me, actually, but I'm not sure that I get the full benefit from it. But then on the other hand, if you meditate, which I try and do, you're told not to expect anything. You're not doing it for any reason. It's you should just sort of do it without any expectations.
That's very much a statement on the writing life as well. It's best not to have any expectations, just to do it for the sake of doing. So the book is out now, and I'll put a link in the notes here as well, along with the other books that we've mentioned. So thank you very much, Sarah, for taking the time to talk to us today, especially on this jet lag return from Japan. I really appreciate it.
No, it's been really good. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Personal Landscapes. If you like the podcast, please give it a rating on iTunes and subscribe through your favorite app. You can find links to today's podcast and more conversations on Books About Place at ryanmurdock.com. You'll also find a donate button if you'd like to contribute to the costs of the show. All donations are greatly appreciated.